excused a guilty love, but even envied it. Besides, she loved Anna from her heart. But actually seeing her among these people so alien to herself, with their fashionable tone which was quite new to her, Dolly felt ill at ease. In particular, it was disagreeable to her to see the Princess Barbara, who forgave them everything for the sake of the comforts she enjoyed there. In general, in the abstract, Dolly approved the step Anna had taken. But it was unpleasant to her to see the man for whose sake the step had been taken. Besides, she had never liked Vronsky. She considered him very proud, and saw nothing in him to justify that pride except his wealth. But involuntarily he, here in his own house, imposed on her more than ever, and she could not feel at ease with him. She experienced the same kind of shyness in his presence that she had felt when the lady's maid saw her jacket. As with the maid, she felt not exactly ashamed but uncomfortable about the patches, so with him she felt not exactly ashamed but ill at ease about herself. Feeling embarrassed, she tried to think of something to talk about. Though she thought that, being so proud, he would not be pleased to hear his house and garden admired, yet not finding any other subject for conversation, she said she liked his house very much. "Yes, it is a very handsome building, and in a good old style," he said. "I liked the courtyard in front of the portico very much. Was it like that before?"
"Oh, no," he replied, and his face lit up with pleasure. "If you had only seen that courtyard in spring!"
And he began, at first with reserve, but more and more carried away by his subject, to draw her attention to various details of the adornment of the house and garden. One could see that, having devoted great pains to the improvement and decoration of his place, Vronsky felt compelled to boast of them to a fresh person, and was heartily pleased by Dolly's praises.
"If you care to see the hospital, and are not too tired, it is not far. Shall we go?"
he suggested, glancing at her face to assure himself that she really was not bored.
"Will you come, Anna?"
he said, turning to her.
"We'll come. Shall we?" she asked Sviatsky. "Mais il ne faut pas laisser le pauvre Veslovsky et Tuskevich se morfondre là, dans le bateau.
We must send to let them know."
"Yes, it is a monument he is erecting here," said Anna to Dolly, with the same sly, knowing smile with which she had previously spoken about the hospital.
"Oh, it's a great undertaking," said Sviatsky. But, not to seem to be making up to Vronsky, he immediately added a slightly condemnatory remark. "But I am surprised, Count, that you, who are doing so much for the people from a sanitary point of view, should be so indifferent to the schools."
"C'est devenu tellement commun, les écoles," answered Vronsky.
"Of course, that's not the reason, but I have been carried away." "This is the way to the hospital," he said, turning to Dolly and pointing to a turning that led out of the avenue.
The ladies opened their sunshades and entered the sidewalk. After several turnings, they passed through a gate, and Dolly saw on the high ground before her a large, red, nearly completed building of a fanciful shape. The still unpainted iron roof shone dazzlingly in the sunshine. Beside the finished building, another, as yet surrounded by scaffolding, was being built. Workmen wearing aprons stood on the scaffolding, laying bricks, pouring water from wooden pails, or smoothing the mortar.
"How quickly your work gets on," said Sviatsky. "When I was last here, there was no roof."
"It will be finished by autumn. The interior is nearly completed," said Anna. "And what is this new building?"
"Oh, that will be the doctor's quarters and the dispensary," replied Vronsky.
And seeing the architect in his short jacket coming toward them, he apologized to the ladies and went to meet him. Avoiding the pit from which the men were taking mortar, he stopped and began heatedly discussing something with the architect.
"The pediment is still too low," he answered Anna's question as to what it was all about.
"I said the foundations ought to be raised," said Anna.
"Yes, of course, that would have been better, Anna Arkadyevna," replied the architect, "but it's done now."
"Yes, I am very much interested in it," said Anna to Sviatsky, who who expressed surprise at her knowledge of architecture. The new building ought to be in line with the hospital, but it was an afterthought and was begun without a plan. Having finished talking with the architect, Vronsky rejoined the ladies and led them to the hospital. Although they were still working at the cornices outside and painting inside on the ground floor, the upper story was nearly finished. Ascending the broad, cast-iron staircase to the landing, they entered the first large room. The walls were plastered with imitation marble, and the enormous plate-glass windows were already in place. Only the parquet floor was not finished, and the carpenters who were planing a square of the parquet left their work and, removing the tapes that kept their hair out of the way, bowed to the gentlefolk.
"This is the waiting room," said Vronsky. "There will be a desk, a table, and a cupboard here. Nothing more."
"This way. We will pass here. Don't go near the window," said Anna, feeling whether the paint was dry.
"Alexei, the paint is dry already," she added.
From the waiting room, they passed into the corridor. Here, Vronsky showed them the new system of ventilation which had been installed. Then he showed the marble baths and the beds with peculiar spring mattresses. Then he took them to one ward after another, to the storeroom, the linen room, showed the stoves built on a new plan, then some silent trolleys to convey necessary articles, and much besides. Sviatsky appreciated everything like one who is acquainted with all the newest improvements. Dolly was simply surprised at what she had never before seen, and wishing to understand it all, asked for information about every detail, which evidently gratified Vronsky.
"Yes, I think this will be the only quite correctly planned hospital in Russia," said Sviatsky.
"And will you have a maternity ward?" inquired Dolly. "That is so much wanted in the country. I often—" Despite his courtesy, Vronsky interrupted her.
"This is not a maternity home, but a hospital, and is intended for all illnesses except infectious ones," he said. "But have a look at this."
And he moved a chair for convalescents, just arrived from abroad, toward Dolly.
"Just look."
He sat down in the chair and began moving it. "A patient is unable to walk, still too weak, or has something the matter with his feet, but he wants fresh air. So he goes out, takes a ride." Everything interested Dolly, and everything pleased her, especially Vronsky himself with his natural and naive enthusiasm.
"Yes, he is a very nice, good fellow," she thought again and again, not listening to him, but looking at him, understanding his expression, and mentally putting herself in Anna's place.
In this animated state she liked him so much that she understood Anna's being able to fall in love with him.
Chapter 21 "No, I think the Princess Daria Alexandrovna is tired, and horses do not interest her," said Vronsky to Anna, who was suggesting that they should go to the stud farm, where Sviatsky wanted to look at a new stallion. "You go, and I will see the princess back to the house, and will have a talk with her, if you do not mind," he added, turning to Dolly.
"I don't understand anything about horses, and shall be very pleased to," answered Dolly, taken rather by surprise.
She saw by Vronsky's face that he wanted something of her. She was not mistaken. As soon as they had passed through the gate back into the garden, he glanced in the direction Anna had taken, and having assured himself that she could not hear or see them, he began.
"You have guessed that I want to talk to you," he said, looking at her with laughter in his eyes. "I know that you are a friend of Anna's." He took off his hat, and with his handkerchief mopped his head, which was getting bald. Dolly did not reply, and only looked at him with alarm. Alone with him, she suddenly felt frightened. His laughing eyes and stern expression scared her. Many diverse suppositions as to what he was about to say flitted through her brain. "He will ask me to come and stay with them and bring the children, and I shall have to refuse. Or to get together a circle for Anna in Moscow. Or maybe it's about Vasenka Veslovsky and his relations with Anna. Or possibly about Kitty and that he feels guilty toward her."
Everything, she surmised, was unpleasant, but she did not hit on what he actually wished to speak about. "You have so much influence over Anna, and she is so fond of you," he said. "Help me." Dolly looked with timid inquiry at his energetic face, which was now wholly and now partly in the sunlight that fell between the lime trees, and then was again darkened by their shadow. She waited for what more he would say, but he walked by her side in silence, prodding the gravel with his stick as he went.
"As you have come to see us, and you are the only one of Anna's former friends who has, and I do not count the Princess Barbara, I feel you have done so not because you consider our position normal, but because, realizing all the hardship of that position, you love her as before and wish to help her. Have I understood you rightly?" he asked, turning toward her.
"Oh, yes," answered Dolly, closing her sunshade.
"But no,"
he interrupted. And forgetting that he was placing his companion in an awkward position, he stopped, so that she was obliged to stop also.
"No one feels all the hardship of Anna's position more than I do. And that is naturally so, if you do me the honor of regarding me as a man with a heart. I am the cause of that position, and therefore I feel it."
"I understand," said Dolly, involuntarily admiring him for the frank and firm way in which he said it.
"But just because you feel you have caused it, I'm afraid you exaggerate it," she said. "I understand that her position in society is a hard one."
"In society it is hell," he said quickly, with a dark frown. "It is impossible to imagine greater moral torments than those she endured for 2 weeks in Petersburg. I beg you to believe me."
"Yes, but here, so long as neither Anna nor you feel that you need society—"
"Society!" he exclaimed with contempt. "What need can I have of society?"
"Till then, and that may be always, you are happy and tranquil."
"I see that Anna is happy, quite happy. She's already told me so," said Dolly, smiling.
And involuntarily, while saying it, she doubted whether Anna was really happy.
But Vronsky, it seemed, did not doubt it.
"Yes, yes," he said. "I know that she has revived after all her suffering. She is happy. She is happy in the present. But I am afraid of what is before us.
I beg your pardon. You want to move on?"
"No, I don't mind."
"Well, then, let us sit down here."
Dolly sat down on a seat at the turn of the avenue. He stood before her.
"I see she is happy," he repeated.
And the doubt as to whether Anna was really happy struck Dolly yet more strongly. "But can it continue?"
"Whether we acted rightly or wrongly is another question. The die is cast," he said, changing from Russian into French, "and we are bound together for life. We are united by what are for us the holiest bonds of love. We have a child. We may have other children. Yet the law and the circumstances of our position are such that thousands of complications appear which at present, while resting after all her sufferings and trials, she neither sees nor wishes to see. That is natural. But I cannot help seeing them. My daughter is not mine by law, but Karenin's."
"I hate this falsehood,"
he said with an energetic gesture of denial, and looked at Dolly with a gloomily questioning expression. She made no answer, but only looked at him. He continued,
"Some day a son may be born, my son. And he will, by law, be a Karenin, and not heir either to my name or my property. And however happy we may be in our family life, and whatever children we may have, there will be no legal bond between them and me. They will be Karenins. Imagine the hardship and horror of this situation. I have tried to speak to Anna about it, but it irritates her. She does not understand, and I cannot speak out about it to her. Now, look at the other side of it. I am happy, happy in her love. But I need an occupation. I have found one. I am proud of it, and consider it more honourable than the occupation of my former comrades at court or in the service. I certainly would not exchange my work for theirs. I am working here, remaining on the spot, and I am happy and contented, and we need nothing more for our happiness. I like my activities. Cela n'est pas un pis-aller, on the contrary.
Dolly observed that at this point his explanation was confused, and she could not quite understand why he had wandered from the point. But she felt that having once begun to speak of his intimate affairs, of which he could not speak to Anna, he was now telling her everything, and that the question of his work in the country belonged to the same category of intimate thoughts as the question of his relations with Anna.
"Well, to continue," he said, recovering himself. "The principal thing is that when working I want the assurance that the work will not die with me, that I shall have heirs. And that I have not got."
Imagine the situation of a man who knows in advance that children born of him and of the woman he loves will not be his but someone else's, someone who will hate them and will have nothing to do with them.
You know, it is dreadful.
He paused, evidently greatly excited. "Yes, of course, I quite understand. But what can Anna do?" asked Dolly.
"Well, this brings me to the point of my talk," he went on, calming himself with an effort. "Anna can do it. It depends on her. Even to be able to petition the Emperor for permission to adopt the child, a divorce will be necessary, and that depends on Anna. Her husband was willing to have a divorce. Your husband had almost arranged it, and I know he would not refuse now. It is only necessary to write to him." He then replied definitely that if she expressed the wish, he would not refuse.
"Of course," he said gloomily, "that is one of those Pharisaic cruelties of which only heartless people are capable. He knows what torture every recollection of him causes her, and knowing her, he still demands a letter from her. I understand that it is painful for her, but the reasons are so important. One must passer par-dessus toutes ces finesses de sentiment. Il y va du bonheur et de l'existence d'Anne et de ses enfants.
I do not speak of myself, though it's very hard on me. Very hard," he said, with a look as if he were menacing someone for making it so hard on him. "And so, Princess, I shamelessly cling to you as an anchor of salvation. Help me to persuade her to write to him and demand a divorce."
"Yes, certainly," said Dolly, thoughtfully, vividly remembering her last conversation with Karenin.
"Yes, certainly," she repeated, resolutely, remembering Anna. "Use your influence with her. Get her to write. I don't wish, and am almost unable, to speak to her about it."
"Very well. I will speak to her."
"But how is it she herself does not think of it?" asked Dolly, suddenly remembering that strange new habit Anna had of screwing up her eyes. And she remembered that it was just when the intimate side of life was in question that Anna screwed up her eyes,
as if she were blinking at her life so as not to see it all, thought Dolly.
"Certainly, I will speak to her, for my own sake and for hers," she said in reply to his expression of gratitude. They got up and went back to the house.
Chapter 22. Finding Dolly already returned, Anna looked attentively into her eyes as if asking about the talk she had had with Vronsky, but she did not ask in words. "I think it's nearly dinner time," she said. "We have not yet seen anything of one another. I am counting on this evening. Now I must go and dress, and you too, I suppose. We have dirtied ourselves on the buildings." Dolly went to her room, feeling amused. She had nothing to change into, as she was already wearing her best dress. But to give some sign that she had prepared for dinner, she asked the maid to brush her dress, and she put on clean cuffs, pinned a fresh bow to her dress, and placed some lace in her hair. "This is all I was able to do," she smilingly said to Anna, who came to her in a third dress, again extremely simple. "Yes, we are very formal here," Anna remarked, as if excusing her own smartness. "Alexei is seldom so pleased about anything as he is at your having come. He is decidedly in love with you," she added. "But aren't you tired?" There was no time to discuss anything before dinner. When they entered the drawing-room, the Princess Barbara and the men were already there. The men wore frock coats, except the architect, who was in a dress suit. Vronsky introduced the doctor and the steward to his visitor. The architect had already been presented at the hospital. The fat butler, his round, clean-shaven face and starched white tie shining, announced dinner. The ladies rose. Vronsky asked Sviatsky to take in Anna, and himself went up to Dolly. Veslovsky offered his arm to the Princess Barbara before Tuskovich could do so, so that the latter, the steward and the doctor, went in by themselves. The dinner, the dining room, the dinner service, the servants and the wine and the food were not merely in keeping with the general tone of modern luxury in the house, but seemed even more luxurious and more modern than the rest. Dolly observed all this luxury, which was new to her, and as a housewife herself controlling a household, she could not help noting the details, though she had no hope of putting what she observed to practical use in her own home, so far was such luxury above her way of life, and asking herself how it was all done, and by whom. Vasenka Veslovsky, her husband, and even Sviatsky, and many others whom she knew, never thought about these things, and readily believed what every decent host wishes his guests to feel, that all that is so well arranged at his house has cost him no trouble, but has come about of itself. Dolly, however, knew that not even a milk pudding for the children's lunch comes of itself, and that therefore so complicated and splendid an organization must have needed someone's careful attention. And from the way Vronsky surveyed the table, gave a sign with his head to the butler, and asked her whether she would take fish broth or soup, she concluded that it had all been done by and depended on the master's care. It was evident that it depended no more on Anna than on Veslovsky. Anna, Sviatsky, the princess, and Veslovsky were all equally guests, gaily making use of what was provided for them. Anna was the hostess only in what concerned the conversation, and that difficult task for the mistress of a house with a small circle which included such people as the steward and the architect, people of quite a different world, who tried not to be abashed by the unfamiliar luxury and were unable to take any sustained part in the general conversation, Anna managed that task with her usual tact, naturally and even with pleasure, as Dolly observed. Reference was made to Tuskovich and Veslovsky having been for a row by themselves, and Tuskovich began to tell about the last boat races at the Petersburg Yacht Club. But at the first pause, Anna turned to the architect to draw him into the conversation. "Nikolai Ivanich," she said, referring to Sviatsky, "was struck by the way the new building had grown since his last visit. Even I, who go there every day, am always surprised how quickly it gets on."
"It is pleasant to work with His Excellency," answered the architect with a smile. He was a dignified, respectful, and quiet man. "It is not like having to do with the local authorities," said he, "where they would scribble over a whole ream of paper. I merely report to the Count. We talk it over, and three words settle the matter."
"American methods," said Sviatsky with a smile.
"Yes. There they erect buildings rationally."
The conversation passed on to the abuses in the government of the United States, but Anna quickly turned it to another theme so as to draw the steward out of his silence. "Have you ever seen a reaping machine?" she asked Dolly. "We had been to look at them when we met you. I saw them myself for the first time." "How do they act?" asked Dolly. "Just like scissors. It's a board and a lot of little scissors, like this. Anna took a knife and a fork in her beautiful white hands, sparkling with rings, and began to demonstrate. She was obviously aware that her explanation would not be understood, but as she knew that she spoke pleasantly and that her hands were beautiful, she went on explaining.
"Rather like penknives," said Veslovsky, playfully, never taking his eyes from her.
Anna smiled slightly, but did not answer him.
"Is it not true, Karl Fedorich, that it is like scissors?" she asked, turning to the steward.
"Oh, ja," answered the German. "Es ist ein ganz einfaches Ding,"
and he began to explain the construction of the machine.
"It's a pity it does not bind the sheaves. I saw one at the Vienna exhibition that bound the sheaves with wire," remarked Sviatsky. "That kind would be more profitable."
"Es kommt darauf an. Der Preis vom Dracht muss ausgerechnet werden."
And the German, drawn from his silence, turned to Vronsky.
"Das lässt sich ausrechnen, erlaubt."
The German was already putting his hand to the pocket where he kept a notebook with a pencil in which he made all his calculations, but remembering that he was at dinner and noticing Vronsky's cold look, he desisted.
"Zu kompliziert macht zu viel Kloppot," he concluded. "Wünscht man Dokots, so hat man auch Kloppots," said Vasenka Veslovsky, making fun of the German.
"J'adore l'allemand," said he, turning to Anna with the same smile as before.
"Cessez," said she with mock severity.
"We thought we should find you on the field, Vasily Semyonich. Were you there?" she said to the doctor, a sickly-looking man.
"I had been there, but had evaporated," said the doctor with dismal jocularity.
"Then you have had some good exercise?"
"Magnificent."
"And how is the old woman? I hope it is not typhus."
"No, it's not exactly typhus, but she's not in a good state."
"What a pity," said Anna, and having thus paid the tribute of politeness to the retainers, she turned to her friends.
"All the same, it would be difficult to construct a reaper from your description, Anna Arkadyevna," Sviatsky chafed her.
"Oh, why not?" said Anna, with a smile which said that she knew there had been something engaging in her way of describing the reaper, and that Sviatsky had noticed it. This new tray of youthful coquetry jarred on Dolly.
"But then Anna Arkadyevna's knowledge of architecture is wonderful," remarked Tuskevich.
"Oh, yes. Yesterday I heard Anna Arkadyevna mention damp courses and plinths," said Veslovsky. "Am I saying it right?"
"There's nothing to be surprised at, considering how much I hear and see of it," said Anna.
"And you, I'm sure, don't even know what houses are made of."
Dolly noticed that Anna did not like the playful tone that had arisen between herself and Veslovsky, yet could not help falling in with it. Vronsky behaved in this matter quite unlike Levin. He evidently did not attach any importance to Veslovsky's chatter, and even encouraged it.
"Come, Veslovsky, tell us what keeps the bricks together."
"Cement, of course."
"Bravo. And what is cement?"
"Well, it's something like paste, you know."
"Putty,"
replied Veslovsky, rousing general laughter. The conversation among the diners, except the doctor, the architect, and the steward, who sat in gloomy silence, was incessant, now gliding smoothly, now catching on something and touching one or other of them to the quick. Once Dolly was stung to the quick, and so aroused that she even flushed up, and afterwards wondered whether she had said anything superfluous and disagreeable. Sviatsky began talking about Levin, and mentioned his peculiar view that machines only did harm in Russian agriculture.
"I have not the pleasure of knowing the gentleman," said Vronsky with a smile. "But probably he has never seen the machines which he condemns, or if he has seen and tried them, has done it just anyhow, and not with a foreign maid, but with a Russian machine. And what opinions are possible on so plain a matter?"
"Turkish opinions,"
said Veslovsky, turning to Anna with a smile.
"I cannot defend his opinions," said Dolly, flaring up.
But I can say that he is a very well-informed man, and if he were here, he would be able to answer you, though I cannot.
I am very fond of him, and we are great friends, said Sviatsky, with a good-natured smile.
Mais, pardon, il est un petit peu toqué.
For instance, he maintains that the Zemtsvos and magistrates are quite unnecessary, and he won't have anything to do with them.
That is our Russian indifference, said Vronsky, pouring water from an iced decanter into a very thin glass with a stem. Not to realize the duties our rights impose on us, and therefore to deny those duties.
I know no one who fulfills his duties more strictly, said Dolly, irritated by Vronsky's superior tone.
I, on the contrary, continued Vronsky, who was evidently for some reason touched to the quick by this conversation, I, on the contrary, such as I am, feel very grateful for the honour they have done me, thanks to Nikolai Ivanitch, he indicated Sviatsky, by electing me Justice of the Peace. I consider that the duty of going to the meetings and considering a peasant's case about a horse is as important as anything else I can do. I shall consider it an honour if they elect me to the Zemtsvo. It is only so that I can make a return for the advantages I enjoy as a landowner. Unfortunately, people do not understand the importance the large landowners should have in the state.
To Dolly, it sounded strange to hear how assured he was of being in the right, here at his own table. She remembered how Levin, who held the opposite opinion, was equally positive in his opinions at his own table. But she was fond of Levin, and therefore sided with him.
"Then we may expect to see you at the next session, Count?" asked Sviatsky. "But you must come in good time, so as to be there on the 8th.
If you would only do me the honour of stopping with me—" "And I rather agree with your brother-in-law," said Anna. "Though I do not go to his lengths," she added, with a smile. "I'm afraid we have too many of these public obligations nowadays. Formerly we used to have so many officials that there had to be an official for everything that was done. And now we have public workers for everything. Alexei has not been here 6 months, and I think he is already a member of 5 or 6 different institutions, guardian of the poor, justice of the peace, a member of the council, a juryman, and member of some commission on horses. Dutranka Solava, all his time will be taken up that way. And I fear that with the multiplication of these positions, they become a mere form. Of how many institutions are you a member, Nikolai Ivanitch?" she asked, addressing Sviatsky. "More than 20, isn't it?" Although Anna spoke playfully, irritation was perceptible in her tone. Dolly, who was attentively watching her and Vronsky, noticed it at once. She also saw that at this conversation Vronsky's face immediately assumed a serious and obstinate expression. Noticing these things, and that the Princess Barbara hastened to change the subject by speaking of their Petersburg acquaintances, and remembering that in the garden Vronsky had spoken about his activities inopportunely, she understood that with this question of public work, some private difference between Anna and Vronsky was connected. The dinner, the wine, the service were all very good, but they were all such as Dolly, though she had become unused to them, had seen before at dinner parties and balls, and like those functions they bore a character of impersonality and strain. Therefore, on an everyday occasion and in a small gathering, they produced an unpleasant impression on her. After dinner they sat a while on the veranda. Then they played lawn tennis. The players, having chosen their partners, took their places on the carefully levelled and rolled croquet lawn, on the two sides of a net stretched between 2 small gilded pillars. Dolly tried to play, but was long unable to understand the game, and by the time she did understand it, she was so tired that she sat down beside the Princess Barbara to watch the others. Her partner, Tuskovich, also gave it up, but the rest played for a long time. Sviatsky and Vronsky both played very well and seriously. They intently followed the ball sent to them, neither hurrying nor hesitating, ran toward it with agility, waited for it to bounce, and then, striking it with the racket, sent it back across the net with good aim and precision. Veslovsky played worse than the others. He was too eager, But to make up for that, his gaiety inspired his companions. His laughter and shouts never ceased. He, as well as the other men, had, with the lady's permission, taken off his coat, and his large, handsome figure in white shirt sleeves, his ruddy, perspiring face and impetuous movements, stamped themselves on the memories of the onlookers. As soon as Dolly that night had gone to bed and closed her eyes, she saw Vasenka Veslovsky rushing hither and thither on the croquet lawn. While they were playing, Dolly was not feeling happy. She did not like the bantering tone between Anna and Veslovsky that continued during the game, nor the unnaturalness of grown-up people when they played childish games in the absence of children. But not to disturb the others and to while away the time, after resting she rejoined the players and pretended to like it. All that day she felt as if she were acting in a theatre with better actors than herself, and that her bad performance was spoiling the whole affair. She had come with the intention of staying 2 days if she could adapt herself to the life. But that evening during the game she resolved to leave next day. Those painful maternal worries which she had so hated on her journey, now, after a day spent without them, appeared in quite a different light and drew her back to them. When, after evening tea and a row in the boat at night time, Dolly entered her bedroom alone, took off her dress and sat down to do up her thin hair for the night, she felt great relief. Even the thought that Anna would come in a moment was disagreeable to her. She wished to be alone with her thoughts. Chapter 23 Dolly was ready to get into bed when Anna, in her nightgown, came into the room. Several times during the day, Anna had begun to talk about intimate matters, but after a few words she had always paused, saying, "Later on, when we are alone, we will talk it all over. I have so much to say to you." Now they were alone, but Anna did not know what to speak about. She sat by the window, looking at Dolly, and mentally reviewing all those stores of intimate topics that had seemed inexhaustible, and could find nothing to say. It seemed to her at that moment as if everything had already been said. "Well, and how's Kitty?" she asked with a deep sigh and a guilty glance at Dolly. "Tell me the truth, Dolly. Is she not angry with me?"
"Angry? No,"
replied Dolly with a smile. "But she hates and despises me?"
"Oh, no. But you know, one does not forgive those things."
"No, no," said Anna, turning away and looking out of the open window. "But it was not my fault, and whose fault was it? What does being in fault mean? Could things have been different? Now what do you think? Could it have happened to you not to be Steva's wife?" "I really don't know. But I want you to tell me this."
"Yes, yes, but we have not finished about Kitty. Is she happy?
They say he's a fine fellow." "It is not enough to say he's a fine fellow. I do not know a better man."
"Oh, I'm so glad. I am very glad." "It is not enough to say he's a fine fellow," she repeated.
Dolly smiled.
"But tell me about yourself.
I have much to talk to you about, and I have been talking with—" Dolly did not know what to call him. She did not like to call him either the Count or Alexei Karilich.
"With Alexei?" said Anna. "I know you have. But I want to ask you frankly, what do you think of me and of my life?"
"How can I tell you all at once? I really don't know."
"Oh, but all the same, tell me.
You see what my life is. But don't forget that you see us in summer when you have come and we are not alone. But we came here in early spring and lived quite alone, and we shall live alone again.
I don't wish for anything better. But imagine me living alone, without him, alone. And that will happen. Everything shows that it will often happen.
that he will spend half his time from home," she said, rising and taking a seat nearer to Dolly. "Of course," she went on, interrupting Dolly, who was about to reply, "of course I won't keep him against his will. I don't keep him. One day there are races and his horses are running. He goes. I am very glad. But think of me. Imagine my position. Oh, but why talk of it?" She smiled. "Well then, what did he talk about to you?" "He talked about what I myself wanted to ask you, so it is easy for me to be his advocate. About whether it isn't possible, whether it can't," Dolly hesitated, "how to remedy, to improve your position. You know my opinions. But all the same, if it is possible, you should get married." "That is, get a divorce," said Anna. "Do you know the only woman who called on me in Petersburg was Betsy Tverskaya? You know her, of course. Au fond, c'est la femme la plus dépravée qui existe. She had a liaison with Truskovich, deceiving her husband in the worst way, and she told me that she did not wish to know me as long as my position was irregular. Don't think I am making any comparison. I know you, my darling. But I could not help remembering. Well then, what did he say to you?" she repeated. "He said that he suffers on your account and on his own. Perhaps you will say it is egotism, but what legitimate and noble egotism! He wants, first of all, to legitimize his daughter and to be your husband and have a right to you. What wife, what slave could be such a slave as I am in my position?" Anna sullenly interrupted her. "But the chief thing he wants is that you should not suffer." "That is impossible." "Well, and his most legitimate wish is that your children should not be nameless." "What children?" said Anna, screwing up her eyes and not looking at Dolly. "Annie, and those that will come." "He may be at ease about that. I shall not have any more children." "How do you know you won't?" "I shan't, because I don't want them." And in spite of her agitation, Anna smiled on noticing the naive expression of curiosity, surprise, and terror on Dolly's face. "After my illness, the doctor told me..." "Impossible," said Dolly, with wide-open eyes. To her, this was one of those discoveries which leads to consequences and deductions so enormous that at the first moment one only feels that it is impossible to take it all in, but that one will have to think over it again and again. This discovery, which suddenly explained to her those hitherto incomprehensible families where there were only one or two children, awoke in her so many thoughts, reflections, and contradictory feelings that she could say nothing, and only stared at Anna with wide-open eyes full of astonishment. It was the very thing she had dreamt of, but now, on learning that it was possible, she was horrified. She felt that it was too simple a solution of too complex a question. "N'est-ce pas immoral?" was all she said after a pause. "Why?" "Remember, I have to choose between two things. Either to become pregnant, that is, ill, or to be the friend and comrade of my husband, for he is my husband, all the same," said Anna, in a tone of intentional levity. "Well, yes, of course," said Dolly, listening to the very arguments which she had put to herself, but not finding them so convincing as before. "For you and for others," said Anna, as if guessing her thoughts, "there may still be some doubt, but for me, remember, I am not a wife. He loves me as long as his love lasts. Well, how am I to keep his love? In this way? She curved her white arms in front of her stomach. With unusual rapidity, as happens at times of great agitation, thoughts and recollections crowded into Dolly's mind. I could not attract Stiva, she thought. He left me for others, and the first one for whom he betrayed me did not hold him, though she was always pretty and bright. He threw her over and took another. Is it possible that Anna will attract and keep Count Vronsky in this way? If he looks for that sort of thing, he will find women whose dresses and manners are still brighter and more attractive. And however white and shapely her bare arms may be, however beautiful her full figure and her flushed face surrounded by that black hair, he will find others still more beautiful, as my horrid, pitiable, and dear husband looks for and finds them. Dolly made no answer and only sighed. Anna noticed the sigh, which expressed dissent, and continued. She had other arguments in store, and such powerful ones that they could not be answered. You say it is not right? But you must consider, she went on, you forget my position. How can I desire children? I am not talking of the suffering, I am not afraid of that. But think who my children would be. Unfortunate beings who would have to bear a stranger's name. By the very fact of their birth, they would have to be ashamed of their mother, their father, their birth. But that's just why a divorce is necessary. Anna did not listen. She wanted to reproduce the arguments with which she had so often convinced herself. What was my reason given me for, if I am not to use it to avoid bringing unfortunate beings into the world? She glanced at Dolly, but not pausing for a reply, continued, I should always feel guilty toward those unhappy children, said she. If they don't exist, at any rate, they are not unhappy. But if they are unhappy, I alone shall be to blame. These were the very arguments Dolly had put to herself, but now she listened without understanding them. How can one be guilty toward beings who don't exist? Thought she. And suddenly the question came into her mind whether it could be better in any case for her favourite Grisha if he had never existed. This appeared to her so monstrous and strange that she shook her head to dispel the confusion of insane thoughts that whirled in her brain. Well, I don't know. But it is not right, she said with a look of disgust. Yes, but don't forget what you are and what I am. And besides, added Anna, in spite of the abundance of her arguments and the poverty of Dolly's, apparently agreeing that it was not right. Don't forget the chief thing, that I am not in the same position as you. The question for you is whether you desire not to have any more children. For me it is whether I desire to have them. And that is a great difference. Don't you see that, situated as I am, I cannot desire them? Dolly did not reply. She suddenly felt that she was so far away from Anna that there were questions on which they could never meet and about which it was best not to talk. Chapter 24 Then there is all the more need to regularize your position, if possible, said Dolly. Yes, if possible, Anna said, in what had suddenly become quite a different, a quiet and sad voice. Is a divorce not possible? I was told your husband had agreed. Dolly, I don't want to speak about it. Well, then, we won't, Dolly hastened to say, noticing the look of pain on Anna's face. "But I see that you look at things too dismally."
"I? Not at all. I am very cheerful and satisfied. You saw that je fais des passions, Veslovsky."
"Yes, to tell you the truth, I don't like Veslovsky's manner," said Dolly, wishing to change the subject.
"Oh, not at all. It tickles Alexei, and that's all. He's only a boy, and entirely in my hands. You know, I manage him just as I please. He's just the same to me as your Grisha."
"Dolly," she said suddenly, changing her tone, "you say I look at things too dismally. You cannot understand. It is too dreadful. I try not to look at them at all."
"But I think you ought to. You must do all that is possible."
"But what is possible? Nothing. You say I must marry Alexei, and that I don't consider that."
"I not consider that?" she repeated, and flushed.
She rose, drew herself up, sighed deeply, and with her light steps began pacing up and down the room, pausing occasionally.
"I not consider it? Not a day, not an hour passes without my thinking about it and blaming myself for what I think, because those thoughts are enough to drive one mad, to drive one mad," she repeated. "When I think of it, I cannot fall asleep without morphia."
"Well, all right. Let us discuss it quietly." They speak of divorce. For one thing, he would not agree now. He is now under the Countess Lydia Ivanovna's influence. Dolly, sitting upright in her chair, with a pained expression of sympathy, turned her head to follow Anna's movements.
"One must try," she said gently.
"Let's grant that. But what would it mean?" said Anna, evidently expressing a thought she had considered a thousand times and knew by heart. "It means that I, who hate him but yet acknowledge myself to blame toward him, and I do think him magnanimous, I must humiliate myself by writing to him? Well, supposing I make that effort and do it, I shall receive either an insulting answer or his consent. Supposing I get his consent." Anna, at that instant, had reached the other end of the room and stopped there, doing something to the window curtain.
"I receive his consent, and my son, they will not give him to me. He will grow up, despising me in the house of his father, whom I have left. Understand that I love equally, I think, and both more than myself, two beings. Seretsa and Alexei."
She came back to the middle of the room, and, pressing her chest with her arms, paused before Dolly. In her white dressing gown, her figure appeared peculiarly tall and broad. She bent her head, and trembling all over with emotion, looked from under her brows with moist, glittering eyes at the thin, piteous-looking little Dolly, in her patched dressing jacket and nightcap.
"I love those two beings only, and the one excludes the other. I cannot unite them, yet that is the one thing I desire. And if I can't have that, nothing matters, nothing, nothing. It will end somehow. Therefore, I can't. I don't like speaking about it. So don't reproach me, don't condemn me for anything. You, in your purity, cannot understand all I suffer."
She came and sat down beside Dolly, peering into her face with a guilty look, and took her by the hand.
"What are you thinking? What are you thinking of me? Don't despise me. I don't deserve contempt. I am simply unhappy. If anyone is unhappy, it is I,"
she murmured. And turning away, she wept. Left alone, Dolly said her prayers and got into bed. She had pitied Anna from the bottom of her heart while they were talking. But now she could not make herself think about her. Recollections of home and of her children rose in her imagination with a new and peculiar charm. That world of her own now seemed so precious and dear that she did not wish on any account to spend another day away from it, and she decided, certainly, to go home on the morrow. Meanwhile, Anna, returning to her boudoir, took a wine glass and put into it some drops of medicine, the chief ingredient of which was morphia. Having drunk it and sat still for a few moments, she entered her bedroom cheerfully and merrily. When she came in, Vronsky regarded her attentively. He tried to find some trace of the conversation which he knew, by her having remained so long in Dolly's room, must have taken place. But in her expression of restrained excitement, which concealed something, he detected nothing except that beauty which, though familiar, still captivated him, her consciousness of this, and her desire that it should act on him. He did not wish to ask her what they had been talking about, but hoped that she would tell him of her own accord. However, she only said, "I am glad you like Dolly."
"You do?"
"But I have known her a long time. I think she is very kind, mais excessivement terre à terre. But all the same, I was very glad she came."
He took Anna's hand and looked inquiringly into her eyes. She, misunderstanding that look, smiled at him. Next morning, in spite of her host's entreaties, Dolly prepared to go home. Lievin's coachman, in his by no means new coat, and a hat something like a postboy's, with his horses that did not match, and the old calèche with mended mudguards, drove up gloomily but resolutely to the covered, sand-strewn portico. Taking leave of the Princess Barbara and of the men was unpleasant to Dolly. After spending a day together, both she and her host felt distinctly that they did not suit one another, and that it was better for them not to associate. Only Anna felt sad. She knew that when Dolly was gone, no one would call up in her soul the feelings which had been aroused by their meeting. To have those feelings awakened was painful, but still she knew that they were the best part of her soul, and that that part of her was rapidly being choked by the life she was leading. When they had driven into the fields, Dolly experienced a pleasant feeling of relief, and she was about to ask the men how they had liked the Vronskys' place, when suddenly Philip, the coachman, himself remarked,
"They're rich, that they are. But yet they gave us only 2 bushels of oats. The horses had eaten every grain before cockcrow. What's 2 bushels? Only a bite. Nowadays oats are 45 kopecks at the inns. When anyone comes to our place, no fear, we give their horses as much as they'll eat."
"A stingy gentleman," confirmed the clerk.
"Well, and did you like their horses?" asked Dolly. "The horses? Fine's the only word for them, and the food is good, too. But it did seem so dull to me, Darya Alexandrovna. I don't know how you found it," he added, turning his handsome, kindly face toward her.
"I felt the same."
"Well, shall we get back by evening?" "We ought to."
On returning home and finding everyone safe and extremely nice, Dolly gave a very animated account of her visit, of how well she had been received, of the luxury and good taste at the Vronskys, and of their amusements, and would not let anyone say a word against them.
"One must know Anna and Vronsky. I have got to know him better now, in order to understand how kind and pathetic they are," said she with entire sincerity, forgetting the indefinite feelings of dissatisfaction and embarrassment she had experienced there.
Chapter 25 Vronsky and Anna went on living in the country in the same way, still taking no steps to obtain a divorce, all the summer and part of the autumn. They had agreed not to go away anywhere, but the longer they lived alone, the more they both felt, especially in autumn when there were no visitors, that they would not be able to hold out, and that a change was inevitable. Their life seemed one that could not be improved.